The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. It's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Amy Rigby. She's got
Hi, Vic.
Hello, Amy.
Sorry, I jumped in.
That's okay. This is actually your third appearance on my program, but only your second appearance with a book. The first time I had you on the show, you were here to perform music because that's what you do. You're a musician, and you've published two memoirs. I had you on for the first one, which is Girl to City, and the new one is called Girl to Country. And I'm hoping that since we have people out there who haven't read the first book or heard that interview, maybe we could cover that first book a little bit to take us into the second one. Is that cool?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. So tell us how you decided to write the first one and what it was about.
Well, the first one, I think at first I got the idea that it was a good way to make money. Mm. An agent in New York got in touch with me back in the, like, probably around the time I first came to play on your show when I had my first solo album, Diary of a Mod Housewife, and the agent was like, oh, you should write a, you know, write a book, a memoir or a book of essays or something. And I thought, oh, you know, that sounded good. Imagining myself like getting a nice advance. I pictured a book that was kind of like a rock Irma Bombeck book. Yeah, just like everyday kind of tales, but with the slant that they, you know, that I was a musician. But eventually I think I just realized I really wanted to write a coming-of-age story about growing up in Pittsburgh and falling in love with music and moving to New York City and just finding my way as an artist in the late 70s, 80s, 90s New York City. So the city was kind of a big character mm-hmm. in the book. So that was the first book, and I think, you know, when I start, and it took a while to get it all done and get it out, but I don't think I planned like necessarily to keep doing memoir, to keep writing books, but I felt like I hadn't really that story ended when my first solo album came out, so that was, you know, the mid-90s, so I felt like there was a lot more to tell and a lot more to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about that first band you were in New York.
Well, there was Last Roundup, but before that
I want the first band.
Yeah, the first one was called The Stair Kits.
There you go.
And that was in sort of a no-wave, we call, you know, the no-wave was kind of around the same time as punk, and yeah, it was just a sort of a different kind of approach to music. It wasn't about kind of like punk, it wasn't about technical prowess, or it wasn't about being that together, and that it was sort of unidentifiable mm-hmm. music in a way. You didn't want to fall into any one kind of category. And so I played the drums in that band, and it, strangely enough, someone, a record label just released an album.
Wow.
We never recorded, but someone recorded our two gigs.
It's like a bootleg then.
Didn't exist very long, but someone recorded them, and it's out on Feeding Tube Records. You know, you can get the LP. And I was a little bit like, oh my God, this is going to be really embarrassing, because I, you know, we all just were learning at the time, and I really had never played drums before. But when I listened to the album, I was actually kind of like pleasantly surprised. I could have been a pretty good drummer.
Wow.
But I saw a review that said, you know, none of the, none of the instruments let it down, that it all holds together well. When I just kind of like, I don't know, everybody had a band for 10 seconds, right?
Sure.
And some of us went on to, you know, play music for many, many years, and some not. But I think, you know, it almost as a weird document of a time and place, it kind of holds up. And we looked really cool.
I'll bet you did.
I have to say, we looked great in the way that a 20-year-old with, like, you know, really kind of mod clothes and black eyeliner.
Sure. Well, you just reminded me. I can't play any instrument, and I'm a terrible singer, and I even had a band. So
oh, there you go.
So you're right. Well, let's talk about the segue then into Girl to Country, because the title really alludes to it. You decided that you were going to move to Nashville and become a songwriter because you knew that there were songwriters in Nashville that were really successful, and you wanted to be one of them.
Yep. I mean, I already was a songwriter, and I'd been writing songs. By the time I moved to Nashville, I'd been writing songs almost 20 years. I'd been writing songs like 15 years for my country band. And they'd been, you know, I'd had an album on Rounder Records, which felt very legitimate to me. I mean, Rounder put out Alison Krauss. It put out Hazel Dickens and Alice Gerard. You know, it put out like really kind of important bluegrass and roots music records. And so I felt like, you know, I felt confident in my ability to write songs, but I wasn't making a living at being in a band. It was very hard work, I had a child. And so, you know, really kind of had to go out on the road to get anywhere. It felt like you couldn't really get much going just by playing at like little bars and clubs in New York City. And I'd had a second band or third band at that point, my all-girl group called The Shams.
Mm-hmm.
And we put out records, and then I had my solo albums were going. But yeah, I just felt like, you know, maybe I would be able to make a living if I went to Nashville, and I'd had some encouragement from song publishers there. So I guess I always thought, oh, well, living outside of New York City is bound to be easier, like if you're a parent and have a kid. And so there were things I didn't really, I thought I'd thought them through, but things I didn't realize, like how in New York you could actually live without a car, you know, but In Nashville you had to have a really good functioning car to get anywhere or do anything. And also the schools were terrible. And it was kind of expensive to rent a place to live there. Cause New York was still, you know, it hadn't quite become, you know, the 2000, it was just going into the early 2000s. So things, it always seemed expensive, but there were ways around that
mm-hmm.
that didn't seem so possible in Nashville. But I went because I thought, you know, I loved country songs, and I liked, you know, a lot of friends from New York had moved to Nashville and were doing well. They were liking it, and it was an easier life in a way. So it seemed worth a shot.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Amy Rigby, and her second memoir is Girl to Country. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, introducing you to your new favorite song. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, and we need to take a quick break, and we'll continue our conversation with Amy Rigby about her second memoir right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO. I've been joined by Amy Rigby. We're talking about her second memoir. She joins us on the telephone in Hudson, New York. As you mentioned, you were on my show performing from your first solo album back in the day, almost 30 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And you ended your first memoir with that album. And in your book, Girl to Country, we learn about just how passionate you are for music and to perform and to write it and to be in that world. And yet, what a brutal world it is. Let's talk about that first album. And I think the thing that really hit me was when it had gotten such great reviews. There's a point in the story where you're going to, like, save your CDs from getting pulverized.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they cut, because I made three albums for the label that put out Diary of a Mod Housewife. And by the time I'd made the third one, like a year after that one came out, which was 2000, they decided to just, like, cut them out of the catalog. So basically they weren't going to distribute them anymore. They weren't going to sell them anymore. And they were slated to be destroyed by this machine I heard about that, like, crushes the CDs and stuff, and so they don't take space up in the warehouse. And so they, you know, I said, well, could I buy them, because I tour a lot, and if I had them, I could just, you know, sell them at shows. And it seems a shame for them to all be, you know, destroyed. So they let me buy them for $1 a piece, and I drove up to the warehouse in Long Island and got the boxes of them. And I actually, most of them have been gone for a while. I'm actually down to the last four copies.
Wow.
of the Sugar Tree, which came out in, yeah, that was 2000. It came out, and I've, that one I've never, it's taken longer for me to sell those, because at gigs, I always, in the book, I talk about the cover shoot for that album and how, you know, I wasn't happy with how I looked. And then the cover got, when it got printed, it just looked really dark. And one thing that really bugged me is they put like these were back in the jewel box days, mm-hmm. and they put like a white spine on, like a white kind of base to the jewel box, and it yellowed over time. Oh. So it just looked really unsightly. And I never proudly displayed it at gigs, because I just always thought the cover didn't look good. I mean, now, you know, I could make a fresh batch of, you know, maybe I'll get like 100 made or something, and just have some that have the cover photo, which is a beautiful photo, but have it printed properly so it really, like, shows the color, and no kind of off-white discolored spine. And just, you know, I think that would be satisfying, and then I'd have it to sell at shows, because I really like the album. Mm-hmm. So it was my Nashville. It was the first album I made, and first solo album I made in Nashville. My band Last Roundup actually recorded a whole album in Nashville in 1984 that never came out.
So that one has never ever been released.
It's never seen the light of day.
Gee.
And it was so devastating when the label that, you know, that brought us there to record said they offered to put it out. This was in Girl to City. They offered to put part of it out on one side and another band on the other side of the album. And they kept going, we're going to put our favorite band on the other side. And we kept going, well, who's our favorite band? Well, it's our favorite band. Well, who are they? What's their name? Our favorite. They were actually called OFB, our favorite band. And I don't know whatever happened to those guys. Anyway, and we just were like crying, and we were so upset, you know.
That's horrible.
That they were not going to put this record out. And I always thought, like, oh, someday I'll go back and listen, and it'll be just an undiscovered masterpiece. And mm-hmm. in fact, it just really wasn't. We were kind of just in between phases when we made it, and it just wasn't all the way good.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't all the way bad. You know, like, if it was kind of really, really primitive, that might have been good, but we were kind of getting better, but not quite good enough to record the way we recorded, and it was produced by Jim Rooney, who, you know, went on to do, you know, like Nancy Griffith albums. Oh, he's produced like tons of records in Nashville, but anyway, so he was like a good, you know, very, very like legitimate guy. But anyway,
yeah,
maybe, you know, as a curiosity, maybe someone would enjoy it. But the main thing really is the Last Roundup album isn't available on, you know, it's not available on streaming. And that will be, I'll be correcting that soon. I, you know, all the band and I have talked about it and we got our rights back to it. So,
well,
anyway,
as I noted, it can be a brutal industry. My guess is Amy Rigby, the book is Girl the Country. You had gotten divorced and you and your ex-husband were juggling child care. He was out touring with, I think, Steve Earle. He's a musician, too. And you're dealing with the financial pressures of all this. And you're also sitting down with songwriters in Nashville, and you're writing songs together, and you're learning about that industry and how it works. But it just never really clicked for you, did it?
I think I realized that, they said when I was moving down there, they said there you can go through one of two doors in Nashville. You could, there's the artist door and the songwriter door, and you have to choose one. And I think, you know, initially that I would go through the songwriter door and that I would really focus my attention on writing songs that would get cut by other artists and just like rushing around town to co-writing appointments, because that's kind of how Nashville works. There's a lot of co-writing. It, you know, just kind of gives a song a bigger chance in mm-hmm. a way if there's more than one writer involved. And it's also collaborative and, you know, people come up with good stuff that way. But I think I just realized being there that I felt more like I was an artist and wanted to focus on what my voice was and what my, you know, just who I was as an artist. And even if it wasn't like as financially successful as being a songwriter for other people, I think it just, it's what drove me, was just like, what do I want to say and what makes me different from, you know, the other people here. And mm-hmm. so, I mean, I did get a publishing deal, which was, you know, a great vote of confidence and helped me buy a house, you know, which is something I'd never have been able to do, living in New York. I wouldn't have been able to own anything. And, you know, that was something that was really hard in Nashville. They didn't have that kind of rent stabilization, rent control like they do in New York. So within the first 2 years of living there, I had to, you know, twice I got told by a landlord, like, sorry, we want to sell the house. You have to move out. Mm-hmm. You know, when you've got a kid, you know, and like trying to work and don't have a partner. I mean, that, like having to move again and again, I think, you know, so buying somewhere so that I could kind of like have some control over where me and my daughter lived, that was like a really huge
thing. That was a big victory.
Thing. Yeah.
Okay, so you're dealing with these financial pressures, and one of the big themes in the story is it's a love story, and you're going to end up falling in love with this guy that you really have been interested in for a long time. But first, you have to get in this relationship with this guy where, as a reader, we're reading, we're going, no, Amy, no, don't go near this guy. Please don't. But this guy offered you.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
This guy offered you a lot, didn't he?
Well, he did. I mean, he was kind of like, oh, you're so talented. You shouldn't have to struggle. I'll make your life a lot easier. And, you know, you'll just be able to write these songs, and, you know, you'll have a nice car to drive, and, you know, like you'll have me to, you know, like, you know, a nice partner that loves you and adores you. And, And yeah, I was attracted to him. But it was also like, you know, and I want your soul, basically.
Right, right. And I'm going to buy you a BMW just to kind of keep you happy.
Right. Sort of. Yeah, it was an abusive relationship. You know, it was really, you know, as the years have gone by, you know, now there's all kinds of terms. There's love bombing. There's, you know, NPD, narcissistic personality disorder. All these things are very identified now. And there's something called coercive control, which is, you know, it's against the law in the UK, and it's, I don't know, some of the states in the US as well. And it's, yeah, it is emotional abuse. It's domestic abuse that isn't physical, but it's a damaging thing. And so that was part of the reason the book was really hard to write, because mm-hmm. a lot of it, when you know, you can't just paint yourself as a victim with these things. You have to take responsibility for your actions. And that was, you know, not to say I hadn't done, I'd probably beaten myself up about it for years, but to just kind of look at it really kind of coldly and go like, oh, this is what happened. This was really damaging, but I got out of it.
So yeah.
I mean, I know that's a spoiler, but you know.
Well, no, it's not, because you fell in love with this fantastic guy. I assume you're still together.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about him. Tell us about this guy.
Well, he's another artist named Reckless Eric, and I discovered he's British. Musician. I discovered his music back in the 70s when I was buying every punk record that came out, and he had his own style. He wasn't like loud and fast and kind of he had a charm and a kind of a wacky outlook that felt very bohemian and individual, and so I kind of kept. He popped up again and again, just as a musical figure that I was interested in, and I started covering one of his songs, his best known song called "Whole Wide World," and through that I ended up and I started going to play in the UK, just started going to do gigs over there, and ended up playing in the town where he'd written the song that I was covering, and the promoter put us together, had him DJ for my show, and it was kind of it was a really, I don't know, was it fate, was it serendipity? It was just one of those strange things where we ended up playing that song together in the first room where he ever played it. So it was just kind of like not many Americans would go to this town called Hull in the northeast of England, because it wasn't very easy to get to. But, you know, it took like 3 trains to get there from London. And anyway, it was just, but why did I keep going back there? But eventually there seemed to be a reason, and that was that we met, but we still didn't get together for some years after, but we kind of, you know, just, we'd made a connection at that first gig, and kind of he kept cropping up here and there. And back then in the early 2000s, people had email, but there still wasn't like Google, and it was hard to find. It was still an old fashioned world as far as like finding people.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like people, when I'd go play in England, I'd be in London or something, and people would say, oh, Reckless Eric said he's going to come and see you and play the gig. And I'd be like, well, where is he? And and he wouldn't show up. And then I didn't know how to find him, really. And then Ira Kaplan from Yellow Tango was looking for him to, they Yellow Tango did this annual Hanukkah show in New York City, and they wanted to have Eric come and play, and I don't know, and he ended up finding him, and that's when I kind of reconnected with him, because they had my band The Shams reunite for that show that year. And so then, yeah, eventually we got together. And as we like to tell people, for our third date, we moved to France together.
I love that. That's so sweet. I mean, you've gone through, you mentioned this painful relationship, and you mentioned some of the struggles that you go through, and life on the road, and the vehicles that just kept breaking down. I love the story where you go to the shop and the guy's like, no, this vehicle is dead.
Which one?
Right, right. You know, just the struggles of it. And now here you are, and you're still performing, right? And do you perform with Eric?
We when we moved to France together, we kind of formed a duo, just like a band between the two of us. And I think at first, because I was still recovering from this very bad relationship, and Eric had a bad one too. Mm. And I think we were kind of in a little bit of a like exile or something. And we were like, oh, we love playing cover songs together. And we said, we'll just play these, you know, covers that we love, like the Archies and Fleetwood Mac, Tom Petty, I don't know, ABBA, just these.
Wow. You know, what do you do by ABBA?
Fernando.
Wow.
That was, I don't know. I always just loved ABBA. And then, yeah, we did some kind of, we did a Who song. We said, we'll just do this in bars in France. And, you know, well, I think we realized pretty quickly that it was our own music that was really, you know, we both were songwriters. And so the idea of covers kind of, we would see these kind of, I won't call them crappy, but just, you know, kind of cover bands, kind of pandering to mostly British audiences, because the French really, you know, in the French countryside, there's not a lot going on. The French don't really go out to bars and stuff at night. So anyway, I learned a lot about France, but yeah, we started touring and leaving France and going to play in the UK a lot, going to Germany, Spain, and back and to the US. Doing these tours together, and it was great. People were like, wasn't there a lot of like fighting, and you know, must have been really hard to tour with your, by then we were married, and you know, hard to do that with your spouse, you know, with all the pressure and the hard, you know, just it's a hard lifestyle, and uh-huh. It was actually really great. We never, you know, we rarely like argued. We always felt like we were on the same side. And you know, sometimes Eric would, you know, there was a couple scenes in the book where he's, you know, something's happening with the sound, or there's a promoter that like came up on stage and unplugged Eric's amp, you know, in the middle of his last song. And the next thing I know, like, they're fighting on stage and there's a security guard and trying to haul Eric off the stage. And I'm hitting the security guard on the back, let him go. And anyway, you know, things like this would happen, but it was very dramatic. And, you know, and then we would just like laugh like crazy afterwards because you can't take this stuff too seriously. I mean, thankfully, none of us ever got hurt, you know, by some of these people, but yeah, you could never take it too much to heart. You kind of just had to. It's a kind of a wacky world anyway. Getting up, and you know, we're both quite insecure people, as most, you know. I mean, I even like reading Elton John's book, you find out, you know, he's really kind of shy and insecure, and those are the people that tend to want to put themselves out in front of the audience. I don't know why, but it's what we do.
Really? Does it make them feel more confident when they're out there performing than they are in normal life? I mean, I'm trying to understand how this works because I would think stage fright would be a big problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I was just listening to a great interview with Marianne Faithfull from like a year or two before she died last year. And she was saying exactly that, you know, that she would just be terrified before she was going to go on stage. Why am I doing this? Why am I putting myself through this? And then as soon as she was up, and, you know, she had real problems with drug abuse because, you know, it was kind of like to kind of numb that feeling. But once she was up there, it was like all of that fell away, and that is how it is. I think it's because you're working up there. You're like the thought of doing what you're going to do is much worse than like actually when you're actually doing it. It feels almost like you're providing some kind of a service, or you're transported in a way. And so I guess that's the kind of honestly, like I just played on Saturday night. If you would have asked me last week, I'd just be like, I don't know why I want to go out and keep. Do I want to keep going out and doing this? But as soon as I do it, I'm just like, it's what I'm here for.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a kind of a common feeling for performers is just like it's only when you're actually doing it does it make any sense. When you think about it, if you think about it, that's ridiculous.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I've been joined on the telephone by Amy Rigby. She's in Hudson, New York. She just came back to the States, and we're doing this interview for her second memoir, and we'll continue this conversation. But first, this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. And we have about 1,200 interviews archived at wyso.org. You can listen to the Book Nook anytime you want. And it's come to my attention recently that we are starting to archive some of those interviews on the YSO page on YouTube. So you have another option there. You can go to YouTube and look up YSO and find some of our recent Book Nook interviews there as well. And the first time I met Amy Rigby was about 30 years ago. She was out touring for her first solo recording, Diary of a Mod Housewife. And so I knew her first as a songwriter. And now I know her as a memoir writer as well. And she's a heck of a songwriter and a heck of a memoir writer. And we spent our first two segments talking about writing that memoir. But now I'd like to focus on her songwriting a little bit. We have Amy on the phone with us in Hudson, New York. She just came back from the UK, and she's here for a very important conference. And right now she's here with us on 91.3 FM. We call it the Book Nook. Amy, it's so good to have you here. Amy, I want to ask you, because I know our listeners want to know this. How do you write a song? How does it happen for you?
It's usually, I mean, sometimes I'll have ideas and like write them in a notebook and then kind of sit down, like, you know, just when I have a little time and just go, I should write that. Other times it'll just happen like at the moment that I pick up a guitar and start. It just kind of like channels through, but like, for example, I was staying with some friends out in California, and we were talking about Bruce Springsteen, and my friend was just like, I'm done. It's been a lifetime of following him. When he comes back around, you know, just like, and he was like, and he said, like, Bruce, I'm breaking up with you. Like, that's totally a song. So I so I just wanted to write that idea of a fan just going, like, you know, how much of my life do I have to give to this artist? Anyway, and it just kind of compelled me. But I never know when I start what really the point is. And the thing that I found through writing that song was he can't, the refrain is, I can't do it. I just can't do it, because he can't break it. He's come with them so far. He's got to see, one of them has to go first, you know, either Bruce or my, he can't end the relationship now. That would be, you know, anyway, so that's, I think that's what compels me to write a song is, and when I write essays too, even when with both of my books, don't really know when I start, I don't know some pat idea of this is what it's going to say. You know, this is what the point, this is the gist of the whole thing. It's always, you do the writing to get to that. I think was it Joan Didion or some great mind said, you know, I write to know what I think or something like that. And it is sort of, that's a paraphrase. I'm not exactly sure who said it and how they said it, but that's the kind of point of it is, you have to go through the process of getting the words and the melody. And, you know, sometimes the music kind of helps find, like, what the meaning is. I think that's a really great thing about writing songs, that you don't have that when you write books. You don't have the, you know, melody, harmony, rhythm, all of that to kind of, you have to just do it with the words alone, and that's why I think it takes longer and is harder and more, it takes more discipline.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have all these little snapshots in your memoirs where you revisit a particular moment, and as a reader we can connect with someone in this scene, and I kept connecting with your dad when he would make an appearance, because your dad was one of these guys who – he's like, well, you know, when are you going to get a real job, right? You know,
yeah.
It's like when you wanted to buy a house, and his reaction to that was like, well.
Can't you find a cheaper house? It's like, yeah, but we're living in this house right now, and they want to sell it, and they'll sell it to me. But, yeah, he's definitely, and when I told him I was working on my first book, and he said, what, music's not hard enough? Now you want to write a book?
The voice of reason, right?
Yes, he never quite understood, but in the end, I felt like he was in his way. He was there for me, even if it was just as somebody that I needed to prove something to.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I think that's something that like, younger artists, like nowadays musicians, coming up with parents who are really into rock music and stuff, and be like, oh, my son's playing the drums, or, you know, like, I'm buying my daughter a guitar. And like, for us, it was like, no, they didn't want us to do this. They would want us to do anything but play music. And it was that sort of struggle to prove them wrong that was, you know, very compelling, and also just gave you like a toughness about it that, you know, like, I'll show you, Dad, you know, like, I will prove to you that, you know, I will prove you wrong. And so I think, yeah, it's not the same anymore, because we all grew up with, you know, rebellion and rock music, and rebellion being a good thing for us. And so then we kind of almost encourage it in our own kids, and that's kind of the opposite. So then they don't have us to rebel against. So,
well, we also have that. That's another sweet aspect of this story, is your relationship with this next generation, with your daughter, and how you talk about that, and you explain how she was getting into music and the stuff that you were doing together, and the relationship between you and your ex-husband, and the fact that, even though you were juggling these wild schedules, she was your priority. You took care of her.
I did. I mean, I still, you know, I think, and that I, it took kind of writing through the part towards the end of the book where she goes off to school, to college, and that's when I moved to France, and I'm in the French countryside, and I'm like looking out at a field of cows, and it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I go, like, when will I stop feeling like I need to be somewhere now to pick my daughter up from school?
Oh.
It was like saying goodbye to the most important job in the world.
Uh-huh.
Having her leave, you know, go off to school, and that, and so I just think it, I don't know if that's like a mom thing or whatever, but I loved being a mom.
So you'd be in France and you're like, oh, I got to go pick up my daughter. Oh, wait, no.
And then realize, you know, it just, and it took such a long, I think, yeah, it took a while to feel, you know, like that, you know, that 3 o'clock rolling around, you know, just wasn't, it wasn't time to go to make the school run.
My guest is Amy Rigby. We've been talking about her memoir, Girl to Country. It's her second memoir after Girl to City. She joins us on the telephone in Hudson, New York, where she's returned back to the States. I've been waiting for her to come back so we could tape this program. And I'm wondering, what is your life like now? Where do you live? Are you still out touring a lot? Tell us what you're up to.
Yeah, I mean, my last year was spent mostly I did some touring, finished the book and, you know, getting the book out. My husband and I are in England. And, you know, but still, I still come back to the U.S. quite a lot. I still play a bunch of gigs, play in the U.K. as well. I'm going to Portugal at the end of February to play 6 shows. That's a nice thing about being over in the UK is it's close to a lot of, you know, the European countries. Some of them, you know, it's like France. It's not, you know, there's a couple gigs there, but for the size of the country that it is, there's really not that much. But I thought I would try Portugal, and I knew a Portuguese promoter. Spain is another place. I went to play in Germany last year. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm here in the U.S. going down to this event called Folk Alliance, which you know, kind of more like a conference than a festival. It's not really open to the public. It's more just for other, you know, singer-songwriters and promoters and agents and stuff. And I don't know. I think, you know, maybe part of it is getting older and wanting to, I don't know, keep looking for connection to keep the, you know, connections alive with other artists and other people who have also kind of spent their lives doing, you know, stuff related to music. And then also trying to get out there and share my writing now and share the books with people I really like, getting, you know, doing some readings and incorporating songs with the reading, you know, that are kind of connected to the pieces that are in the book, and yeah, kind of weaving it all together is kind of a nice framework, and also helps me because the books are, you know, my past, I can revisit songs from my catalog from back, you know, songs I haven't played in years from the early 2000s, because I keep making records, and I just had a record come out in 2024, and I'll make another record this year, and so I'm still, you know, still writing songs and putting out new music, but I like to celebrate my old stuff too, because I feel proud of it, and then of course 2026 is the 30th anniversary of Diary of a Mod Housewife, my first solo album. So I kind of want to do some shows for that.
Oh, that,
so I'm always cooking up schemes.
That album totally holds up. I loved it when it came out. I loved it when you came and played some tunes from it for us here 29 years ago on WYSO. And I love these memoirs. And you're talking about Folk Alliance you came over here for that. I used to hear a lot of people talk about that. I used to go to a lot of music conferences. And I'm wondering, who is that artist that's going to be at Folk Alliance this year that you're really excited about seeing again, a friend?
Steve Poltz.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I don't know if you know him, but mm-hmm. he's just a force of nature. He plays something like 300 gigs a year. He is a dedicated troubadour and super entertaining and just so much fun. So he's very inspiring, and I'm sure there'll be. I actually one thing I got to do a few days ago was play a couple songs at a tribute to Jill Sobule, who was a really wonderful songwriter, artist who died in May of 2025, and she was a dedicated troubadour and just a fearless performer, and I got to play some of her songs with a bunch of other songwriters and artists that loved her in New York City. One of the people that played was a guy named Vance Gilbert. Now, I've heard his name for many years.
I love him.
But, I'd never encountered him before. He was amazing, and so he's going to be at Folk Alliance. And, yeah, I only got to see him sing one of Jill's songs, but his just general vibe, and he was just such a trip, so I'm going to be looking for him.
Who got to sing I Kissed a Girl?
What's that?
Who got to cover I Kissed a Girl?
Well, it was going to be Madeline Peru, but she was ill and couldn't come. So at the last minute, it was Vicki Peterson from the Bangles, Jenny Muldaur, and me. The three of us had to just kind of work it up at the last minute, and we each took a verse. So that was, I thought that was, it felt like a big pressure because it's just such an iconic song. But like I first met Jill in Nashville when she was in the studio mixing that record. So I felt really connected to that song because I knew as they were mixing it at Woodland Studios in Nashville, it felt like it was a hit. Like you just knew it was a hit song. Mm-hmm. And that was just it was pretty magic to like get to be there. It almost doesn't seem real, but I feel lucky. I think that's a nice thing. Like if you put yourself out there, it's like how I met my husband, Eric, and if you put yourself out there, you will have things happen. Some of them, like Charles, the bad guy, aren't good, but some of them are really positive and just kind of almost like unbelievably magic. So,
yeah. Well, Amy, it's been so great to talk to you again. Thank you so much for...
Thank you, Vic. I'm really glad to be in touch with you and to get to come back on the Book Nook.
It's really appreciated. The new one is Girl to Country. It's the second memoir by Amy Rigby. And are you working on a third one?
I do have, when I lived in France, I started really writing. They had invented that blogging platform, Blogger. And there was a lot of expat bloggers at the time. And I wrote like a couple times a week about, trying to buy a baguette, and trying to learn, all the kind of things that you kind of go through living in a new country. Someone gave me a good title, Girl to Another Country.
I like it.
Which I think is good. If you have a title, that's like part of the hard work done okay. already. So it'll be something along those lines. And yeah, I feel like I've got to get started really soon because who knows how much time any of us have here. So
understood. Well, thanks again, Amy.
Thanks, Vic. Yeah, take care.
You too.
Talk to you again, I hope.
I hope so, too. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. Once again, the book is Girl to Country by Amy Rigby. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.